Blog Talk Radio.
Hello everyone, this is Peter Paul Brazola, and we tried a new version of our March to the Scaffold, and it sounded distorted, so we'll correct that in the meantime. Anyway, it's Wednesday, the 11th of August. Not too many major events or birthdays today. Those of you who like music and are into recordings, the great British conductor Raymond Lopardi also teaches at or has taught at Indiana University. People would not familiar with, they have a great music school there. I didn't go there. It's the equivalent of DePaul in Chicago, Juilliard in New York, Curtis Institute in Philadelphia, and he's made quite a few recordings. They're very good. Also, those of you who are concerned about, quote, conservative politics and ministers, Jerry Falwell was born today. And this is an important death today, in 1868, Thaddeus Stevens. He was the architect of the brutal Reconstruction that he tried to impose, and was some of it was imposed in the South and created a lot of the problems that we still have today politically, and not only in race relations, although they've been magnified by people like Charlie Rangel and Maxine Waters and Jesse Jackson and Al Sharpton, Cecil Williams, Willie Brown. They really set back race relations with this, with their race politics, cries of racism, whenever something goes wrong. And that so-called professor from Harvard, Gates, who's not related to Secretary of Defense, Robert Gates. But Thaddeus Stevens wanted to punish the South for what he saw was a rebellion of a petulant child. He was also beaten with a cane. I think it was Charles Sumner, who was another member of the House, U.S. House of Representatives, and during one of the debates he beat Stevens so badly that he never recovered. And in fact, the beating went on, and one of, I think it was Sumner's associates, held a gun to back off anybody who tried to stop the beating. And there's a famous, if you can see this movie, we have an archival copy in the Brazola Archives, Carson Brazola Archives, historical video, audio video archives, of, it's called Tennessee Johnson. And this was a film made during the early part of World War II on Andrew Johnson. And in it, it has, Lionel Barrymore plays the role of Thaddeus Stevens. It's a great movie. Van Heflin played the role of Andrew Jackson. Andrew Johnson. Let me get my Tennessee Andrews confused. And it's a great movie, and it's got an interesting history. Also out of that period came Dr. Mudd, the guy who gave medical aid. He didn't know who John Wilkes Booth was, and he was sent to that to the Tortugas, that island off of Florida, as a federal prison, and to this day, his family, Roger Mudd, who's a former CBS correspondent, is a direct descendant, and they were trying to get a formal pardon from the government. I don't think the Mudd family has ever gotten that, but it was another great movie on Dr. Mudd, who was railroaded. I mean, that's nothing. We've seen more and more of that with some of our courts, and we'll get into that another day. And let's see, there are not many birthdays today. We have Oh, I can't even read my own writing. Shame on me. Now, the events are not many events on this day in August. In 1909, the first SOS was broadcast by a U.S. Ship off of Cape Hatteras. And then we have other football fans. In 1919, the Green Bay Packers was founded. And then we had Babe Ruth in 1934. That was an interesting year. Babe Ruth was the first one to hit 500 homers. And in 1934, this is local, the first prisoners were sent to Alcatraz. And among them, Al Capone went there after he was convicted of fraud on his sales of his illegal liquor, which came from Canada, by the way, which Canadians thought we were stupid for engaging in, for passing a law to ban the sale and consumption of alcoholic beverages. Only, this is not well publicized, only Sacramento wine was permitted. In fact, the big winery, one of the big and the only religious winery in California, in Northern California, is Christian Brothers. And it's kind of funny because their marketer is a Jewish family, Schlechtman, I think. And of course, they're better marketers, and the monks made better wine. But anyway, during the Prohibition, only Sacramento wine was grapes were permitted to be pressed for Sacramento wine because of his religion. And Christian Brothers became very big after Prohibition because they were still, in effect, in the business doing Prohibition. And Prohibition, a lot of people don't realize that, are not familiar because we don't have the history, is that it was started by the women who said that, you know, all of this food, the grain and other foodstuffs, which were made into alcohol, should have been available for food. And of course, a lot of people, and I've talked to some of my relatives who were alive at the time, that had we not had World War One and gotten the Volstead Act, that the boys were here, quote unquote, is what I was told, that Congress would have never been allowed to have passed Prohibition, the Volstead Act it was called. And it was kind of stupid, but I don't agree. They're talking about legalizing marijuana. The problem with that, and I'm digressing from the script for today, but having been an old hippie myself, gone through the love bud of the late 60s, summer of love, and all of that, the marijuana of the 60s is not the same marijuana that's being smoked and peddled and sold and passed off as medical today. This stuff is lethal. And because of the developments in hydroponics and all that in growing the stuff, that it's much more potent. And the medicinal qualities in marijuana that they claim you need smoke marijuana in order to kill the pain, THC or whatever can be extracted from the marijuana bud and injected or taken orally or whatever to kill your pain. You don't have to smoke it. And, of course, a lot of people think the marijuana cognoscenti realized that this new marijuana is much more potent and it's in the same should be in the same category as alcohol when you drink and drive, drink excessively. Or some people can't even handle marijuana. I remember during the Haight-Ashbury days that there were people who didn't agree with them. And, of course, we just had more to smoke. But this is one of the fallacies, I call it one of the political fallacies, that all pot is equal and it's not harmful. This stuff is much more potent and it's dangerous. And they're not telling you that this stuff is much more potent than the love bud, which was mellow, yellow, and all of that, of the 60s and the early 70s. So we'll get back to our other things. Well, Al Capone, now this a book has just come out, and I've talked about this from time to time. One of the political myths was that if you watched the Untouchables, the 50s program, which was promoted by Walter Winchell, who was this horrible correspondent. He railroaded people like Rose DiAquino, who I know or knew, who was in Japan after 1940, just before Pearl Harbor, and what the she was a first generation Japanese, And what the Japanese did, the Japanese who had emigrated to Hawaii and to America, they would send their children back to Japan to immerse them in the Japanese culture. So she was caught over there. She had just graduated from UCLA, from LA. She spoke English, knew nothing about Japan, and Pearl Harbor broke out. So what happened was what everybody did, all the combatants, they interned foreign nationals and foreign aliens in that case. And so she was, there were about 20 of these women over there, and plus there was an Australian and somebody else. And they were told, if you don't broadcast, we're going to send you to a concentration camp and you'll be tortured, raped, and all the rest. So here's this 20-year-old girl, young lady, with the others, and she, you know, what was she going to do? And there were other people who really betrayed the United States. But the myth was there was only one Tokyo Rose who was the broadcaster. There were about 20 of these girls, and there was an Australian involved, and he surfaced later. But anyway, at the end of the war, Walter Winchell was a columnist, was this rabid columnist. His family was Russian-Jewish, should have been deported. They were beating the drums to get Tokyo Rose. She was in the same category as Tojo, who was the head of the junta that was running the military camp, running the government in Japan. And so when MacArthur and the Japanese signed the peace treaty on the USS Missouri, when the Americans landed in Tokyo, everybody went looking for Tokyo Rose, not knowing that there were 20 of these girls, about 20. And so she happened to be in the wrong place at the wrong time. I think she was pregnant. She got the name Aquino because she had married a Filipino. And he was never allowed to enter the United States. I don't know what, if he was a U.S. citizen or what. We'll get into that. My father knew something about that, and I had relatives in the islands at the time. Anyway, and I did some work with veterans who survived Bataan Corregidor. So she was arrested and detained and interrogated. And the Army and the Justice Department realized they had a weak case, and they weren't going to prosecute her. But the Hearst papers and Walter Winchell and all the anti-Japanese in this country, remember, we had the 442 Division, which were American Nisei, second and third generation Japanese, who fought valiantly in Europe and took some of the highest casualties. I think they were at Monte Cassino and other places. They were also used as interpreters in the Pacific. And Senator Inouye, who lost one arm, he was part of that. He was Hawaiian Japanese. But anyway, they beat the drums that the government should prosecute Tokyo Rose. So what happened was the word is, and this came up in the John Lynn case, the American Taliban, as he's called, this kid, that when an American commits treason against the country, he or she is supposed to be brought to the nearest U.S. judicial district. In this case, it would have been Hawaii. However, the Hearst people and Walter Winchell and some Justice Department people realized that they would not get a conviction. They wanted a conviction. Would not get a conviction in Honolulu because of all the Asians. So what they did was they brought her to San Francisco, and we'll put this up on the web. That courtroom, very few people know about it today. It still stands. It's a beautiful building. It's now the Ninth Circuit Appellate Court, and it's used for executions to decide whether state and federal prisoners, well, we don't have a federal execution, but state prisoners who are facing the gas chamber or injection file their stays of execution or waivers or get the retrial, all that. And we'll get into it. It's very interesting what goes on at that building. She was tried there. Now, I knew I was working in civil rights in the 70s, and I met the lawyer who defended her at the time, Wayne Collins Sr. He died. She was convicted 7 years and sent to a prison in West Virginia, the same prison that Martha Stewart went to. Then she later returned, she was paroled, and we tried to get her pardon, and worked on President Ford, and he did grant her a pardon. She set up shop in Chicago under Taguri, and I met her there, although I had worked independently on her case supporting the pardon by President Ford. And I had met her a couple times, and she died recently, and there was something on the Disney Channel about her. But she, this is a classic case of railroading in the federal courts, and when the media morons like Winchell are allowed to run amok and not be challenged. Anyway, that's only part of his story. He was involved in promoting the fiction that Elliot Ness was the guy who brought down Al Capone. And I brought this up several times on this show, talked about it on other shows as well. And I had worked in the federal building in Chicago where some of the people were still around, they were nearing retirement, who had been involved in the prosecution of Al Capone and others, Frank Nitti and some of the other people. I don't know if Nitti was still alive, but or was convicted. One of them blew their brains out, committed suicide. But anyway, it's a fascinating case about jury tampering and all that. Anyway, it wasn't Elliot Ness. It was an IRS accountant named Elmer Irie. Now, a book has just come out exposing this. We've talked about it, and we knew about it. And Elmer Irie has never really gotten all of the credit he should have, but he had obtained a copy of Al Capone's books of the illegal liquor sales that were coming in from Canada and the money he was taking in. And that's how they brought down Al Capone. Elliot Ness had very little to do with breaking up prohibition violations in Chicago or stopping them. After that, after Al Capone, it's interesting, Judge John Wilkinson, long since dead, was the judge assigned to hear his Al Capone's case. He learned that the jury had been tampered with. So what he did is, just before the trial started, Judge Wilkinson switched juries, and that stopped that. This also, jury tampering happened in the John Gotti case in the 80s when John Gotti was prosecuted by the federal government in the New York Southern District. We also had jury tampering in the Steve Neri case. We'll get into that another day because it has international ramifications. But anyway, Al Capone was sent to The Rock. And I recommend this movie, the original 1959 film, Al Capone. Rod Steiger played Al Capone. Great film. Al Capone goes in the film, and this is accurate. He was sent to The Rock, and some of his enemies were there. And when they had the opportunity, they beat him up. When he left Alcatraz, he had had an advanced case of syphilis. He had had syphilis before, and it wasn't detected, or the medical doctors didn't pay attention to it. So he retired to Florida, and he died of syphilis of the brain, I think in 1947. But this is another example of how these media morons can manipulate or try to manipulate the press and people and the readership and the people listening to their broadcast. And it still goes on today. We've seen it with the Obama mania, and we've seen it with the gay agenda with this Proposition 8. A lot of this, in fact, we've seen the infiltration of not only the federal courts but of media by these so-called gay, lesbian, NAMBLA civil rights groups. What they're doing is pushing what I call crotch politics. But we need this history, this accuracy, to understand what happened then and what is happening now in its relationship. And this is also important. In 1954, the French and the Viet Minh, as they were called at the time, Ho Chi Minh, started formal peace talks in the Indochina War, and then the United States got involved. Now, President Eisenhower, the French government, the French were fighting two wars, one in Algeria and then this one in Indochina, two wars. And the French had conscription at the time. I think they still do, or draft. And the French, young French, were getting tired of dying in the rice paddies of Vietnam or dying in the desert and being tortured. Horrible things were being done by the Arabs, which they don't talk about. Islam is a very brutal, dirty religion when it comes to war. And long history, well documented, of what they do to prisoners. But anyway, the French were tired of it. It was costing them a lot of money. They asked the United States to get involved, and Eisenhower gave them limited aid, like planes, that sort of thing. And Dien Bien Phu finished it. We have an archival video on that, and it's too detailed to get into it. But the French built this fortress way up near to try to shut off the flow of supplies coming from China. And the Vietnamese, the Viet Minh, as they were called at the time, chopped through the jungle. They did what old military people never think that the enemy will do. They became innovative, and they hacked their way through the jungle to bring up cannon, and they just bombarded this fortress in the middle of nowhere, and the French were forced, and the Foreign Legion were forced to surrender. It was a horrible defeat for the French, and that precipitated these formal peace talks. And then the United States got involved. We didn't get out until the Nixon administration nearly 20 years later. So that this date in history is very important. And then the race riots started, and we're still going through this. In 1964, we had race riots in Paterson, New Jersey. And, of course, New Jersey has had Newark and places like that have had a lot of race conflict between the races. Then in 1965, and I was in L.A. at the time, visiting relatives, had the Watts riots. Now that's, and those of you who remember that, some of the scenes that are still broadcast on TV, that race riot was very important to California elections because Pat Brown, the father of Jerry Brown, Pat Brown was out of the state at the time. So the lieutenant governor was a guy named Glenn Anderson. He didn't know what to do. He delayed sending in the National Guard and dealing with the problems. And there were a lot of problems. The L.A. cops were among the most brutal in the country. And I had a FBI official once say to me, we were talking, and he said, you know, I go down there, and I'm a federal official, and they look at me, and I feel guilt, wonder what I've done. But they made a habit of this whole appearance of being, you know, really tough, don't mess with me type of guys, and we'll run you in, and we were incorruptible, we don't take bribes like other cops and all that. And I think it was Parker who was the police chief down there. I had relatives who worked for the LAPD. Anyway, what this did was the people of California saw that Pat Brown administration was incompetent in dealing with this type of crisis. And so Ronald Reagan decided to run against Pat Brown, and this was an issue, and he defeated Pat Brown for the governorship. And then Pat Reagan went on to win another term, and he dealt with the riots at Berkeley, where I was in 68. And then we know that he ran for president twice, won Bush at the convention in Kansas City, where my old radio boss, Leo Cosmo Lee, did the first broadcast for NPR of a convention, and he set it up in Kansas City. Reagan lost the nomination, and he ran again and won the nomination and won the presidency. And the rest is history. Then we had, this is still reverberating today, in 1978, Pope Paul VI died, and he began to deal with some of the problems of pedophilia in the Catholic clergy. But it's so widespread and so ingrained, and the church is what they used to do. When we were in school, we had a couple of priests that molested and a brother, and nothing was done about the nuns. Now I look back, and some of them were lesbians. But we had a priest, he's long since dead, God rest his soul, molested boys. And as soon as the Monsignor, who was a fanatic about smut on the walls and that kind of thing, Eugene Mulcahy, great priest, he kicked the priest out, Father McHugh. He's long since dead, so I'm not hurting anybody. And we don't know where he went. But later we find out that what the church was doing was transferring these priests to other dioceses and really not sending them to rehabilitation if they could be rehabilitated. So now we have the problem, and it's costing big bucks. People aren't going to church. They're very angry. And we used to have, you know, the German, Irish, Polish, Spanish, were all the early generations were very religious and very intensely Catholic, but a lot of people have fallen away or just don't go to church or don't like the politics, whatever, and the church is not getting the collection money on Sunday, even though the Roman Catholic Church in America is the biggest recipient of federal funds for the various charities, the hospitals, the schools. But we have this problem. They got a lot of real estate, and I was told by somebody who was dealing with the church's real estate, and she happened to be a Lutheran, that they were not in the religious business, they're in the real estate business. And I said, what are you doing working for the Catholic Church? She didn't answer that. But anyway, those are the assets the church have, and it's a worldwide problem, and they better deal with it fast, and they better deal with it thoroughly, because it's bankrupting the Catholic Church. And then, getting back to Reagan, in 1984, while waiting to go on the air, and this is why you got to always be leery, and you see these guys at congressional hearings, they put their hand or their handkerchief over a mic when they're talking to somebody, because an open mic, and you say the wrong thing, or even if it's a joke, can get you into a lot of trouble. Well, Reagan made this statement, in 5 minutes we're going to bomb Russia. And people just freaked because of his reputation. So you got to be very careful. And here's a citizenship question that came up. Rabbi Meir Kahane was a New Yorker, U.S. citizen, born here, I think, and he was very radical, extremely radical, who claimed he remembered the Holocaust and all that, and wasn't going to put up with any guff from these Nazis. He later went to Israel, ran for the Knesset, which is their parliament, and there's a problem that an American citizen cannot take a position in a foreign government and still remain an American citizen. So what he did was he renounced his U.S. citizenship. He was later assassinated by, I think, another Israeli or a Jewish kid, but he was murdered or assassinated. Now, getting back to some of the things today, I would recommend that you go to my Amicus Veritas YouTube site. Everybody, those of you who are worried about keeping your houses and who have, you know, worked and paid your taxes and money was, this is one of the scandals in some cases that I worked on, that these people who operate these bogus nonprofits were taking, withholding taxes out of their employees' checks, but they were not remitting them promptly to the IRS or to the state or wherever there was taxes due from an employee's to be withheld. And what happened, this is one of the rackets that these bogus nonprofits were doing, Juan Pifre in particular, and his name will come up again and again. So that's one of the scandals. But the biggest scandal involves publicly funded real estate. And I have, in our print copies, we published, and you can see some of this on our web at amicusveritas.org, amicusveritas.org, or verzola.com, verzola.com. Dollar a month houses, and this is an even better one. We had one of these bogus housing corporations, Chinese Community Housing, which is also connected to the Anchor Baby scandal. We'll get into that because we exposed that one in print, and it's now on the front burner of the media and some people in Congress. And you ought to be concerned about that. But anyway, what they were doing was they were getting money from HUD, about $23,000 to $28,000 a month, and on the checks from the government were the names of the proposed or the supposed recipients, their social security number, and the amount. So we discovered through a whistleblower that the long dead head of HUD in Region 9, a guy named Robert Pitts, and we call this article "It's the Pitts." He had died in 1982, and we got his death certificate, and on it is the social security number. So we matched that with these checks, and it's up on our YouTube site. Homeless people getting homeless assistance, dead people getting homeless assistance payments. But they weren't getting them directly because they were dead. Not only that they were dead, but the operator of the hotel were getting these checks. And in this case, a guy named Robert Bedford Pitts, he was the first black head of HUD in Region 9. He died in 1982. Then in 1997, these checks started to appear on his name, Robert B. Pitts, Social Security number, which matched on the death certificate, and the amounts for him was $591 per month. However, there was more money. If there's a vacancy, and that was a racket, the operator of the hotel got the vacancy money. If there was damage or so-called damage to the apartment, to the room, actually it wasn't an apartment, there was money for that, a couple hundred dollars. And it could be just for this one dead person who would never live there and was never alive to be eligible for the checks, it could be about over $1,000. And there were a lot of these that we found. And so published one of those. It's up at our Amicus Veritas YouTube site. It's the latest video verite up there, AMICUSVERITAS. And there's more of this stuff. And this happens in San Francisco. And everybody's dumping on Bell, California for this mayor who got $1 million. And here in San Francisco, some of the worst corruption has gone on, and citizens complained about it. It was ignored. The media morons, in fact, some of them not only got condos themselves, but they got parking ticket exemption. And we'll get into that because there was a lawsuit, and we'll put that documentation up there. Yeah. And we did a survey on cities that if they gave their media people a parking ticket exemption, supposedly the parking ticket exemption is for a newsman or photographer or broadcaster to park their vehicle in a no parking or zone or to avoid getting ticketed at a parking meter so they could cover the story. Well, in San Francisco, these guys sit on their asses, and women too, and all day the cars parked there, and they don't cover anything. If they do, it's as little as possible to get that big fat check and to avoid getting a ticket. Or tickets, because if they were parked there all day, they were eligible to get more than one ticket. So that went on in San Francisco. And then condos financed by HUD and redevelopment bonds went to a couple of people. And then we had people like Julian Malvo. She was operating a bogus nonprofit. Her mother was getting money, and she was with CNN, and she's now the head of some women's college in North Carolina. But this is part of the corruption that went on in San Francisco. And also one of the best was the dollar a month houses. There were about five of them that went to politically connected ethnics. The Mary Rogers case, her house, she wouldn't even pay the dollar a month. She was working for the housing authority and filed lawsuits, and they gave her a dollar a month house to shut her up. She wouldn't pay the dollar a month. She also ran up water bills of up to $500 a month, and the redevelopments, the city's redevelopment agency paid for that. And this went on for years, and she made a comment when they tried to get her to pay even a dollar. She said, "You can burn this house down, but I'm not paying you any GD rent." That's the attitude. She's dead. Then a deputy U.S. attorney, when he retired, gave me the files on the case because she had sued the federal government. And he was telling me that he had gone up in an elevator with her, and she was to a trial involving litigation involving her, and that she was talking about which restaurant should we go to get the best steak. And here she was suing the government for a dollar a month house, that kind of thing. So this is what goes on in San Francisco. Also today, I understand, somebody that I knew when I was working in the federal building, Dan Rostenkowski, died today. And if you watch Fox News, I keep thinking this guy Beckel, if he doesn't look like Rostenkowski, if they were separated at birth, I don't know. You can decide if you watch Hannity when he has this great American debate thing, and Beckel is just like Rostenkowski, a bull in the china shop, a bully, bombastic, and half the time he doesn't know his one end from the other, and he tries to fool people and bully them, and he runs this I'm an expert bit. I was a deputy assistant State Department Secretary of State, and of course that's nothing more than glorified clerk. But anyway, Rostenkowski, along with Nancy Pelosi, Nancy D'Alessandro Pelosi, who came from Baltimore. She is not a native San Franciscan, never was, and a lot of people hate her, cannot stand her, because she's so arrogant, among other things, and they think she's on Botox and a few other things, and we won't talk about. Anyway, she and Rostenkowski got together and put together this piece of legislation providing government subsidies and underwriting of so-called affordable housing, these things like the Sweetheart Hotel where they had these dead people getting homeless assistance payments. And so Rostenkowski, and the deal was for 20 years, the government site acquisition paid for the acquisition of the site, and if there had to be construction or rehab, government paid for that. And then they provided subsidized rents and salaries and rehab every couple of years. Millions of dollars have gone into these projects. Now, at the end of X amount of years, I think it's 20 years, that the operators of that project get to keep, they get the title. And any of the tenants who were supposed to be, the building had to be kept affordable in rents for the 20 years, they can evict those people, and then those people have no recourse, the tenants have no recourse, even though the American taxpayer had paid all this money, site acquisition, rehab, construction, subsidized rents, all of that, salaries, for the operators of these bogus nonprofit housing corporations. Well, Rostenkowski and Pelosi were responsible primarily for that piece of legislation, and we call it Rostenkowski's Revenge. I met him years ago when I was in the federal building. You know, typical Chicago type of politician. Now, the other things that have been going on in this corrupt city, America's most corrupt city, is a little story there. We have public employees who use the local government's computers to wander through the porn on the web, and they do this on government time. Now, we have a lot of cases, and when I have done my research in the military court cases, we're seeing more and more cases of military personnel who have access to military computers. They're looking up porno and carrying on, and that's illegal, and they get court-martialed for that. We also had a case here in the Ninth Circuit federal courts. Some people were using the court's computers to travel down the web looking at porno. So it's increasingly an issue, and it's getting widespread and across. It's not only the local perverts, but we see people in the military, we see people in the federal judicial system, we see people. I know you heard about the scandals that went on in Washington. So it exists, and of course all they do is tap them on the fingers and say, "Oh, you bad boy, you bad girl." Very little is done to stop it. Now, the other something just cropped up, this homicide case in San Francisco involving Hugues de la Plaza, that it was so unusual to have the French government send over a magistrate. We had the French TV, French radio over here. I'm familiar with the case. I was acquainted with Hugues. And I thought it was odd until I started checking the background of some of the people, and Michel Debray was the Minister of Justice in the French government, and his grandson was one of the correspondents over here, and I talked to him, and we put this up on our Amicus Veritas YouTube site, and on the Hugues de la Plaza case. Well, there's been another similar type of mysterious death, although we think it's got a gay connection. A guy was stabbed to death a couple days ago. And the family, Hugues' family is from France. Excuse me. They went back, and they've been back here a couple times, but they have contacted San Francisco police, I think, and offered assistance because they think their son, Hugues de la Plaza, was murdered by the serial killer. So we'll keep you informed on that. Now, since people are excuse me, asking about a lot of these federal programs, I thought they asked me to do some encore, so I'm going to run Will Rogers, who gave a talk here in California on government programs. Oh, here we go. Come on, where is it? Oh, what's going on here?
Made in this country, there is not who shall be relieved and whose money shall relieve him, but who shall be the one that plays Santa Claus and actually hands out the presents, you know. That's the main problem today, is who hands out the presents. Huey says he should wear the whiskers. And it is, and Mr. Hopkins, they say no, we've got sleigh bells ourselves. Governor Talmadge, down in Georgia, he had a plan. It hit a rut and knocked him right out of the bread line last week. It's been a bad week on plans all around. I'm not going to get discouraged, though. In fact, these other failures, well, they've given me confidence, you know. More hope that my plan will be a success. Now, my plan, to state it in a nutshell, and in fact, that's where all plans come from. And the nut should never be cracked. But here is my plan in a nutshell. My plan is a plan to end all plans. It's to do away with all plans. That's what it is. There ain't but one place that a plan is any good and that it'll really work, and that's on paper. But the minute you get it off a sheet of paper and get it out in the air and it blows away, that's what. Now, Mr. Roosevelt, he dragged more heat foam arms out of little red schoolhouses. And they had.
Oh, I got cut off there, but there's a lot of relevance. That was done during the 30s at broadcast here in California. But this is just what happened in Washington. Remember, Mr. Roe likes to consider himself a disciple of FDR, and with all these plans, and I think Pelosi and Reid and Steny Hoyer and that whole crowd wanted Congress to, at least the House of Representatives, because the senators had taken off till after Labor Day, wanted them to pass this plan or this federal expenditure to aid teachers, you know, and of course the teachers, they expect to repay this largesse by voting for the Democrats. And I'm very concerned, having been experienced with vote fraud and the voter registration fraud, that Dick Morris, Luntz, who's the other guy, Roe, seem to be overconfident that the Republicans and the Tea Party people are going to capture Congress, or at least House of Representatives. And I think they're underestimating people who are in power who don't want to give it up and even want more. And you can never underestimate these people. We've seen all the things they've done with voter fraud. What happened, the thing I keep telling people is absentee ballot voter fraud. They have what the scam was here in California when in the last presidential election. Acorn and these radical groups got these, I guess, vagrants together, paid them some money to go and register to vote down in Southern California, and then demanded during the time frame to do an absentee ballot. After that, they put them on buses and ran them up to Northern California, where they did the same thing. And I saw some of this. And then on the Mikus Veritas YouTube site, we reveal in video what we had run in on hard copy, Veritas USA, where a city official, I mean a city official I knew, lived at the remotest area of San Francisco on Ocean Beach. That's where Pacific meets the highway. And he got a couple weeks later, he gets this voter registration card in the mail, which, you know, you get when you register to vote. It takes about 30 days. And he said, well, this person never lived here. And then he got a couple others. And then he realized what was going on. So he went to the voter registrar and says, I'm getting mail from the Department of Elections for people I don't know, I don't want to know, and who never lived here. Yet they had voted absentee. And this is where this is part of the scam. Also, we discovered that the radical left, the Democrats or the Demorats, had registered people in office buildings, which is illegal. You can't have an office as a residence. And, of course, the lease of an office does not allow living quarters, unless it's one of these live workplaces, which are not in the financial district of cities. Then they had people registered all kinds of places, in parking lots, homeless shelters, you know, and there were multiple registrations of the same person at different addresses. So this is what went on. And now we have a stupid legislator, and I'm going to get on his case again about this because he should know better, who wants to expand the absentee voter program. And all he's doing is making it easier for people of vested interest to commit more voter registration and voter absentee voter fraud. So that's what scares me. Also, they say, now, I did bring up, and it's on our Mikus Veritas YouTube site, in 1950, Scott Lucas was the Democrat from Illinois, U.S. Senator, and the majority leader in the U.S. Senate. His opponent was Everett McKinley Dirksen, who was out of Congress at the time. He ran for the U.S. Senate against him. He defeated the majority leader. It's quite a coup. And this could happen again with Harry Reid. I understand that a lot of people want Harry Reid out. They don't, you know, he's a bad Mormon. That's what I heard, and some other things. And, of course, he's lied about the health care plan and a lot of other things and made a lot of questionable money. And as a Mormon, I thought that Mormon males were supposed to do 1 year of missionary work. I don't know if he ever did it. But he must have learned something. Now, his background is that he was a Capitol Hill cop, and he went to night law school, which is admirable. But he must have learned a lot of dirt while he was a Capitol Hill cop, and that may be his ammo, like J. Edgar Hoover. That's why he stayed in power so long, because he had dirt on just about piles on a lot of people. So, you know, that we may see an upheaval there. But I am concerned that of the overconfidence expressed by some of these media people and so-called savvy political consultants, because you can never underestimate the deviousness of the opponent. And, you know, look at their point of view. Do they really want to give up power? They want more, so they'll be even further entrenched. So you got to be realistic about that. Now, we're going to have in our Friday show, just finishing the file on Anchor Babies, and we've got a couple of birth certificate copies of suspected Anchor Babies, Chinese, where they stayed in San Francisco. And this material dates back 10, 15 years. We brought it up then, and I raised the issue then. I said they're staying in affordable housing, subsidized by the American taxpayer. They go to public hospitals to have children, to have a child. Then they get an American birth certificate. Then they go back to Asia. We don't know what is coming back in 10, 15, 20 years. And there's no way so far, nothing done so far, to make an unimpeachable piece of evidence of a baby that the footprint or whatever, I don't know if that technology was in effect at the time, that if you get something that's indelible or DNA, so when that person comes back and he's suspected, and comes back with an American birth certificate and comes from Asia or Mexico or some of these places, that whether that we can tell if that the DNA that was taken when that child was born is matches the DNA of the young adult or the young man or young woman. So that's been suggested. Some people would consider that an invasion of privacy. Incidentally, we will be bringing up, we have it, it's just so much, but it's got to be done, that there's a big market, that Cyprus seems to be the country, the biggest economy there seems to be offshore financing of all these porno webs on the websites, particularly the gay stuff and the military and young boy stuff. It's just outrageous, outrageous, outrageous. But that seems to be the industry on the island of Cyprus, which had its own battles between the Greeks and the Turks. And those of you who remember Archbishop Makarios, who was the head of the Greek community on Cyprus, was described as a very devious, wily monk. And it's another reason that I suggest, and other people who are familiar with clerics in politics, that I used to say a man can't serve two masters. Not only does one of them get shortchanged, but loses their shorts as well. So this is what happened. He became the president of Cyprus, and then the Turks felt, because they were in the minority, that they were being discriminated against, and there was that war that went on between Greece and Turkey over what was going on in Cyprus. But apparently they patched up their differences, and now, in effect, they've dropped their shorts and they're engaged in all this pornography. Also, in the Rock of Gibraltar, the British still keep the monkeys there. That's the rumor, that when the monkeys go, that Spain always wanted Gibraltar back. The Spanish nation lost it in a war with Britain, and the British, because it guards the entry to the Mediterranean, the British refused to give it up, and they've never been pushed off, even though the Spanish have tried to get the British to either negotiate or just to leave. And, of course, the British are like bulldogs. Once they get their teeth into something, it's very hard to dislodge them. But that's become a source of financing and registration for this porno. But people are concerned. This was brought up to me recently. Some of the gays have been going into the men's locker room at these health clubs, and these are not gay health clubs because there are such places, and taking their camera phone or their little cell camera phone or flip or whatever, and going into the showers and locker rooms and take pictures of people. And people are objecting because they're pretending that they have a camera cell phone, they're pretending to use the cell phone, which they're not supposed to use, and they're taking these pictures. These things end up on the World Wide Web, and people are getting smart. And there's also hidden cameras, and they've been used by these international pornographers, and there's big money in this. And then, of course, I did do XY Magazine, which was a NAMBLA type. They've gone bankrupt, but they had a million a database of a million young names, as young as I think 13, and this is an asset. And they're facing the same problem as, in a different way though, as Facebook, because Facebook realizes that the operators realize they have millions of people and personal data in their databases, and this is marketable material. And people are saying, wait, I don't want my personal material to be sold to some marketeer or whatever, but they've got a problem there, and it's a privacy problem. And the same thing, it's even worse with XY Magazine because of what it is, a pedophile magazine, and all these kids can be propositioned or hustled by these commercial interests, which could be anything from tennis shoes, deodorant, or pornography, what have you. So, you know, we don't live in dull times, do we? excuse me. Now, the other thing people need to realize is that there is a difference between an illegal alien, migrant, and somebody who's an illegal immigrant. Illegal immigrants, if we're looking at the language correctly, specifically, an immigrant is coming to this country to emigrate, I-M-M-I-G-R-A-N-T. And the opposite of emigrate, E-M-I-G-R-A-N-T, which is to go out, which is what, who's that actor who's gone nuts? Who did Road Warriors and Mel Gibson. Mel Gibson was born in upstate New York and a Catholic family, big Catholic family. And the family went to Australia, but I guess he kept his American citizenship. And there's this question of dual citizenship. Can a person have loyalty to two different governments? I guess I've heard this argument, that it's like having two different wives in a harem. So I said, well, I don't see it that way, and a lot of other people don't, but I think we ought to stop this dual citizenship garbage and this feint and just say, hey, you live here, you pay taxes here supposedly, you send your kids to school here, you get the benefits, you should be exclusively an American citizen, or if you want to go to Canada, you want to go to Ireland, whatever. Understand that the Americans have gone to Ireland are now coming back because their economy is in shambles too. They don't want to end up eating potatoes if they could get them or afford them. But people have got to realize that there is a difference. And the people here who are illegal aliens, a lot of them, and I've talked to some, we've done the series on how these people survive in an urban setting, are coming here to work, to find work, because they cannot support their family back in South America. They're not coming here to get a green card. They're not coming here to take citizenship. They're not coming here for subsidized housing. But we do have people who are doing that. We also have this horrible situation in San Francisco where we had, what's his name, Campos. He came here illegally when he was a teenager, and he got into gay politics and all that. And now he's on the legislature for the city, what we call the Board of Supervisors, or what you would call back east, aldermen or selectmen, city council, and he is very opposed to protecting our borders, a border, because nobody's talking about the Canadian border. We'll get into that next week or soon. Largest undefended border in the world, 3,000 miles, and there are a lot of, we have a lot of activity up there, drugs coming through western Washington called the Okanagan Valley. We have illegal aliens coming through Vancouver and that part of the Northwest. We have in the eastern seaboard people coming through. There's an Indian reservation on the border between New York and Canada. So we have that, and they were running liquor through there years ago and cigarettes. But nobody's looking at that, and there have been terrorists in Canada. It's been very quiet, and then, of course, you know, it's easy to cross the Ambassador Bridge from Windsor, Ontario, to Detroit or other places, even row across the Detroit River. But these are things that are going on, and nobody's looking at that, or if they're looking at that, they're not talking about it. And so if they're doing something about it quietly, that's good. But if they're not, we need to have something done about that. And, of course, when Al Capone was alive, they used to bring down liquor from Canada because Canadians did not have prohibition, didn't believe in it. And that's where a lot of the good liquor, not the bathtub gin, good liquor came illegally across the U.S.-Canadian border. So, you know, there's a lot of history there about crossing the border illegally, and people do it. But we have these people who come here illegally, and they got into politics, like in San Francisco, which they seem to think this is a separate country, and they have opposed the ending the sanctuary city status that San Francisco set up for itself, other cities, and they cover up for illegal aliens. And there is a HUD-funded building where the operators, Mission Housing, claims, and when they were criticized for it, they were saying, we have the right to provide housing for Latino people. I mean, but the American taxpayer was paying for this, and they were not paying for knowingly for illegal aliens. So there was that arrogance. And these people are really arrogant. I think maybe if we start deporting some of these people, then they'll realize that Americans are serious about the security of our borders, that our laws are going to be enforced on these issues. And if you're not coming here to contribute, but to co-opt and corrupt, which a growing number of them are with their agendas, then, you know, go back to where you came from and stay there. Don't even try to come back or go someplace else. But we have that. We have these arrogant people who come here, and some of them come here legally, and they're going to tell us how to run our country. Those of us who said, hey, you know, that's really presumptuous, that's arrogant, and we're not going to put up with that. We don't have to. And we're going to stand firm, speak out, and stand firm on these issues. And if you don't like America or the states, then go someplace else and do it quickly, and don't let the door hit you in the butt as you cross the border or get on that airplane or that tramp steamer. So that's a little rant on that. And then I recommend these other websites that you go to. Check out Jack Cashel. He's got a great summertime reading book, Popes and Bankers, which gets into the history of the financial crises and problems here in the United States, which are still relevant to what's going on today. And I have a rare interview, a speech that was done by a sideman. We have it in the archives. I'm talking about the SNL and how relevant what he was saying then it applies to today. You know, history repeats itself, and often in the worst possible ways the second time around. Now, what was I going to say about Al Capone? I forgot. I recommend that movie, Al Capone, 1959 film. You'll understand about some of these things and jury tampering and the whole myth about Elliot Ness. Incidentally, Elliot Ness, after he failed in Chicago, he went to work in Cleveland, and then he had a sex murder, and he became the head of the Cleveland police or whatever they call them in Cleveland, and he bungled that, and he left and died in disgrace, or, you know, I guess you could say disrepute. People, he didn't have his reputation that Walter Winchell would have us believe when he put out that series, The Untouchables. We refer to it as The Unthinkables. So, excuse me. Well, let's end with our favorite theme, which is so applicable. Where is it?
What do you say, Ben? Want a hand?
No, you guys go ahead. I got too much on my mind to play poker.
King bets.
Cost you five. Tony, up to you.
Okay, Tony, what are you
going to
do?
I'm in.
So am I.
Five,
five. K2. Gentlemen, here we are, and one thing is clear. We gotta pick a candidate for Congress this year. Big ace.
Ace bet.
You'll pay through the nose.
Okay, where?
possible flush? Nothing.
Gentlemen, how about some names we can use? Some qualified Republican who's willing to lose.
No, we don't want a qualified Republican to lose. But anyway, see you Friday. This is Peter Paul Brazola. Thank you for tuning in, and go to our website, our YouTube site, Amicus Veritas. Good night. Okay. Oh, I don't know what's going on here. But anyway, take care.